After the Siege. My grandmother, Valentina Rockman, now Valerie Goldman, was a little girl when Hitler laid siege to Leningrad, 12 years old. All my life she told me that she'd experienced horrors during the war that I'd never comprehend, but I'm afraid that in my callow youth I discounted this. My grandmother wasn't in a concentration camp, and as far as I knew, all that had happened is that she'd met my grandfather, a Red Army conscript, in Siberia. They'd deserted and gone to Azerbaijan, and my father had been born in a refugee camp near Baku. That's dramatic, but hardly a major trauma. Then I went to St. Petersburg with my family in the summer of 2005, and my grandmother walked us through the streets of her girlhood, and for the first time, she opened up about the war to me. She pointed out the corners where she'd seen frozen, starved corpses, their asses sliced away by black market butchers. The windows from which she'd heaved the bodies of her starved neighbors when she grew too weak to carry them. The stories came one after another, washing over the sun-bleached summertime streets of Petersburg, conjuring up a darker place, frozen over, years into a siege that killed millions. Harrison E. Salisbury's 900 Days is probably the best account of those years, and the more I read of it, the more this story fleshed itself out in my head. I wrote almost all of it on airplanes between London, Singapore, and San Francisco, in great 5,000 and 6,000 word gouts. My grandmother's stories found an easy marriage with the contemporary narrative of developing nations being strong-armed into taking on rich country copyright and patent laws, even where this means letting their citizens die by the millions for lack of AIDS drugs. Mandela's son died of AIDS. Imagine if one of the Bush twins died of a disease that would be treatable except for the greed of a South African company. Destroying their education system, or punishing local artists to preserve imported, expensive culture. The United States of America was a pirate nation for the first 100 years of its existence. Ripping off the patents and trademarks of the imperial European powers, it had liberated itself from with blood. By keeping their GDP at home, the U.S. revolutionaries were able to bootstrap their nation into an industrial powerhouse. Now, it seems, their descendants are bent on ensuring that no other country can pull the same trick off.
The day the siege began, Valentine was at the cinema across the street from her building. The cinema had only grown the night before, and when she got out of bed and saw it there, all gossamer silver supports and brave, sweeping candy apple red curves, she'd begged Mata and Papa to let her go. She knew that all the children in the building would spend the day there. Didn't the pack of them explore each fresh marvel as a group? The week before, it had been the clever little flying cars that swooped past each other with millimeters to spare, like pigeons ripping over your head. Before that, it had been the candy forest where the trees sprouted bonbons and sticks of rock, and every boy and girl in the city had been there, laughing and eating until their bellies and sides ached. Before that, the swarms of robot insects that had gathered up every fleck of litter and dust and spirited it all away to the edge of town where they'd somehow chewed it up and made factories out of it, brightly colored and airy as an aviary. Before that, fish in the river. Before that, the new apartment buildings. Before that, the new hospitals. Before that, the new government offices. Before that, the revolution, which Valentine barely remembered. She'd been a little kid of 10 then, not a big girl of 13 like now. All she remembered was a long time when she'd been always a little hungry, and when everything was gray and dirty and Mata and Papa whispered angrily at each other when they thought she slept, and her little brother Trover had cried thin, sickly cries all night, which made her angry too. The cine was amazing. The greatest marvel yet as far as she was concerned. She and the other little girls crowded into one of the many balconies and tinkered with the controls for it until it lifted free. How they'd whooped! And sailed off to its own little spot under the high swoop of the dome. From there, the screen was a little distorted, but they could count the bald spots on the old war heroes' heads as they nodded together in solemn congress, waiting for the films to start. From there, they could spy on the boys who were making spitball mischief that was sure to attract a reprimand. though for now the airborne robots were doing a flawless job of silently intercepting the boys' missiles before they disturbed any of the other watchers. The films weren't very good, in Valentine's opinion. The first one was all about the revolution, as if she hadn't heard enough about the revolution. It was all they talked about in school, for one thing. And her parents. The quantities, the positive quantities of times they'd sat her down to explain the revolution, which was apparently one of their duties as bona fide heroes of the revolution. This was better than most, though, because they'd made it with a game, and it was a game that Valentine played quite a lot and thought was quite good. She recognized the virtual city modeled on her own city, the avatar's dance moves taken from the game, too, along with the combat sequences and the scary zombies that had finally given rise to the revolution. That much she knew, and that much they all knew. Without the zombies, the revolution would never have come. Zombieism and the need to cure it had outweighed every other priority. Three governments had promised that they'd negotiate better prices for zombieism drugs, and three governments had failed, and in the end, the cabinet had been overrun by zombies who'd torn three MPs to bits and infected seven more, and the crowd had carried the PM out of her office and put her in a barrel and driven nails through it and rolled it down the riverbank into the river. Something so horrible and delicious that Valentine often thought about it like you poke a sore tooth with your tongue. After that, the revolution, and a new PM who wouldn't negotiate the price of zombieism drugs. After that, a PM who built zombieism drug factories right there in the city, giving away the drug in spray and pill and needles. From there, it was only a matter of time until everything was being made right there. Copies of movies and copies of songs and copies of drugs and copies of buildings and cars and you name it. And that was the revolution. And Valentine thought it was probably a good thing for everyone except the old PM who they'd put in the barrel. The next movie was much better, and Valentine and Lisa, who was her best friend that week, put their arms around each other's shoulders and watched it avidly. It was about a woman who was in love with two men, and the men hated each other, and there was fighting and glorious kissing and sophisticated cutting insults. And oh, they dressed so well! The audio was dubbed over from English, but that was okay. The voice actors they used were very good. After the second showing, she and her friends allowed their seats to lower and set off for the concession stand, where they found the beaming proprietors of the cinema celebrating their opening day with chocolates and thick sandwiches and fish pies and bottles of brown beer for the adults and bottles of fizzy elderflower for the kids. Valentine saw the cute boy who Lisa liked and tripped him so he practically fell in Lisa's lap, and that set the two of them to laughing so hard they nearly didn't make it back to their seats. The next picture barely had time to start when it was shut off and the lights came up and one of the proprietors stepped in front of the screen, talking into his phone, which must have been dialed into the cine sound system.
Comrades, your attention, please. We have had word that the city is under attack by our old enemies. They have bombed the East Quarter and many are dead. More bombs are expected soon.
They all spoke at once, horrified non-words that were like a panic, a sound that made Valentine want to cover her ears.
Please, comrades, the speaker said.
He was about 60 and was getting a new head of hair, but he had the look of the old ones who'd lived through the zombieism, a finger or two bent at a funny angle by a secret policeman, a wattle under the chin of skin loosened by some dark year of starvation.
Please, we must be calm. If there are shelters in your apartment buildings and you can walk there in less than 10 minutes, you should walk there. If your building lacks shelters, or if it would take more than 10 minutes to go to your building's shelter, you may use some of the limited shelter space here. The seats will lower in order, two at a time, to prevent a rush. And when yours reaches ground, please leave calmly and quickly and get to your shelter.
Lisa clutched at her arm. Valet! My building is more than 10 minutes' walk! I'll have to stay here. Oh, my poor parents! They'll think you're safe with me, Lise, Valentine said, hugging her. I'll stay with you and both our parents can worry about us. They headed for the shelter together, white-faced and silent in the slow-moving crowd that shuffled down the steps into the first basement, the second basement, then the shelter below that. A war hero was handing out masks to everyone who entered, and he had to go and find more child-sized ones for them, so they waited patiently in the doorway.
Valentine, you don't belong here. Go home and leave room for we who need it.
It was her worst enemy, Rita, who had been her best friend the week before. She was red in the face and pointing and shouting.
She lives across the street. You see how selfish she is. Across the street is her own shelter, and she would take a spot away from her comrades, send them walking through the street.
The hero silenced her with a sharp gesture and looked hard at Valentine.
Is it true?
My friend is scared, she said, squeezing Lisa's shaking shoulder. I will stay with her.
You go home now,
the hero said, putting one of the child-sized masks back in the box.
Your friend will be fine, and you'll see her in a few minutes when they sound the all clear. Hurry now!
His voice and his look brooked no argument. So Valentine fought her way up the stairs, so many headed for the shelter, and out the doors, and when she stepped out, it was like a different city. The streets, always so busy and cheerful, were silent. No air cars flew overhead. It was silent, silent. Like the ringing in your ears after you turn your headphones up too loud. It was so weird that a laugh escaped her lips, though not one of mirth, more like a scared laugh. She stood a moment longer, and then there was a sound like faraway thunder. A second later, a little wind. On its heels, a bigger wind, icy cold and then hot as the oven when you open the door, nearly blowing her off her feet. It smelled like something dead or something deadly. She ran as fast as she could across the street, pounding hell for leather to her front door. Just as she reached for it, there was a much louder thunderclap, one that lifted her off her feet and tossed her into the air, spinning her around. As she spun around and around, she saw the brave red dome of the city disintegrate. Crumble to a million shards that began to rain down on the street. Then the boom dropped her hard on the pavement and she saw no more. The day after the siege began, the doctor fitted Valentine for her hearing aid and told her to come back in 10 years for a battery change. She hardly felt it slide under her skin, but once it was there, the funny, underwatery sound of everything and everyone turned back into bright sound as sharp as the cinnies had been. Now that she could hear, she could speak, and she grabbed Papa's hands.
The cinny, she said. Oh, Papa, the cinny, those poor people, what happened to them?
The work crews opened the shelter 10 hours later, Papa said.
He never sugarcoated anything for her, even though Mata disapproved of talking to her like an adult.
Half of them died from lack of air. The air recirculators were damaged by the bomb, and the shelter was airtight. The rest are in the hospital.
She cried.
Lisa.
Mata took her hands. Lisa is fine, she said. She made sure we told you that. She cried harder, but smiling this time. Trover was on her mother's hip, and looking like he didn't know whether to stay quiet or pitch one of his famous tantrums. Automatically, Valentine gave him a tickle that brought a smile that kept him from bursting out in tears. They left the hospital together and walked home, though it was far. The metro wasn't running and the air cars were still grounded. Some of the buildings they passed were nothing but rubble. And there, robots and people labored to make sense of them and get them reassembled and back on their feet. It wasn't until the next day that she found out that Rita had been killed under the cinny.
She threw up the porridge she'd had for breakfast and shut herself in her room and cried into her pillow until she fell asleep.
3 days after the siege began, Mata went away.
You can't go! Papa shouted at her. Are you crazy? You can't go to the front. You have 2 small children, woman.
He was red-faced, and his hands were clenching and unclenching. Trover was having a tantrum that was so loud and horrible that Valentine wanted to rip her hearing aids out. Mata's eyes were red.
Harold, You know I have to do this. It's not the front. It's our own city. My country needs me. If I don't help to fight for it, then what will become of our children? You never got over the glory of fighting, did you? Her father's voice was bitter in a way that she'd never heard before. You're an addict. She held up her left hand and shook it in his face. An addict? Is that what you think? Her middle finger and little finger on that hand had never bent properly in all of Valentine's memory, and when Valentine had asked her about it, she'd said the terrible word, knuckle breakers, which was the old name for the police. You think I'm addicted to this? Harold, honor and courage and patriotism are virtues, no matter that you would make them into vices and shame our children with your cowardice. I go to fight now, Harold, and it's for all of us. Papa couldn't find another word to speak in the 2 seconds it took for Mata to give her 2 children hard kisses on the foreheads and slam out the door. And then it was Valentine and Papa and Trover, still screaming. Her father fisted the tears out of his eyes, not bothering to try to hide them, and said, Well then, who wants pancakes? But the power was out, and he had to make them cereal instead. 2 weeks after the siege began, her mother didn't come home, and the city came for her father. Every adult, comrade, every adult fights for the city. My children, he sputtered. Mata hadn't been home all night, and it wasn't the first time. She and Papa barely spoke anymore. Your girl there is big enough to look after herself, aren't you, honey? The woman from the city was short and plump and wore heavy armor and was red in the face from walking up 10 flights to get to their flat. The power to the elevators was almost always out. Valentine hugged her father's leg. My papa will fight for the city, she said. He's a hero. He was. He'd fought in the revolution and he'd been given a medal for it. Sometimes, when no one was looking, Valentine took out her parents' medals and looked at their tiny writing, their shining, unscratchable surfaces, their intricate ribbons. The woman from the city gave her father a look that said, You see, a child understands. What's your excuse? Valentine couldn't quite feel guilty for taking the woman's side. Lisa's parents fought every day. I must leave a note for my wife, he said. Valentine realized that for the first time in her life, her parents were going to leave her all on her own and felt a thrill. 2 weeks and 1 day after the siege began, her Mata came home and the city came for Valentine. Mata was grimy and exhausted, and she favored one leg as she went about the flat making them cold cereal with water. All the milk had spoiled, and dried fruits. Trover looked curiously at her as though he didn't recognize her, but eventually he got in her way and she snapped at him to move already and he pitched a relieved fit, pounding his fists and howling. How that little boy could howl. She sat down at the table with Valentine and the two of them ate their cereal together. Your father? He said he was digging trenches. That's what he did all day yesterday. Her mother's eyes glinted. Good. We need more trenches. We'll fortify the whole city with them, spread them out all the way to their lines, trenches we can move through without being seen or shot. We'll take the war to those bastards and slip away before they know we've killed them. Mata had apparently forgotten all about not talking to Valentine like a grown-up. The knock at the door came then, and Mata answered it, and it was the woman from the city again. Your little girl, she said. No, Mata said. Her voice was flat and would not brook any contradiction. She'd bossed her 9 brothers, Valentine's uncles, now scattered to the winds, and then commanded a squadron in the revolution, and no one could win an argument with her. As far as Valentine knew, no one could win an argument with her. No, the woman from the city said. No is not an option, comrade. Mata drew herself up. My husband digs. I fight. My daughter cares for our son. That's enough from this family. There are old people in this building who need water brought for them. There's a creche for the boy underground. He'll be happy enough there. Your little girl is strong, and the old people are weak. No, her mother said. I'm very sorry, but no. She didn't sound the least bit sorry. The woman from the city went away. Mata sat down and went back to eating her cereal with water without a word. But there was another knock at the door 15 minutes later. The woman from the city had brought along an old hero with one arm and one eye. He greeted Mata by name, and Mata gave him a smart salute. He spoke quietly in her ear for a moment. She saluted him again, and he left. You'll carry water, Mata said. Valentin didn't mind. It was a chance to get out of the flat. One day of babysitting the human tantrum had convinced her that any chore was preferable to being cooped up with him. She carried water that day. She'd expected to be balancing buckets over her shoulders like in the school books, but they fitted her with a bubble suit that distributed the weight over her whole body and then filled it up with a hose until she weighed nearly twice what she normally did. Other kids were in the stairwells wearing identical bubble suits, sloshing up the steps to old people's flats that smelled funny. The old women and men that Valentin saw that day pinched her cheeks and then emptied out her bubble suit into their cisterns. It was exhausting work, and by the end of the day she had stopped making even perfunctory conversation with the other water carriers. The old people she met at the day's end were bitter about being left alone and thirsty all day, and they snapped at her and didn't thank her at all. She picked Trover up from the creche, and he demanded that he be carried, and she had half a mind to toss him down the stairs. But she noticed that he had a bruise over his eye, and his hands and face were sticky and dirty, and she decided that he'd had a hard day too. Mata and Papa weren't home when they got there, so Valentin made dinner. More cold cereal and some cabbage with leftover dumplings kept cool in a bag hung out the window. And then, when they still hadn't returned by bedtime, Valentin tucked Trover in and then fell asleep herself. 1 month after the siege began, Valentin's mother came home in tears.
What is it, Mata?
Valentin said, as soon as her mother came through the door.
Are you hurt?
Her mother had come home hurt more than once in the month, bandaged or splinted or covered in burn ointment or hacking at some deep chemical irritation in her throat and nose and lungs. Her mother's eyes were swollen like they had been the day she'd been caught by the gas and they'd had to do emergency robot field surgery on them. But there were no sutures. Tears had swollen her eyes.
New trench buster missiles on the Eastern Front, she said. The anti-missiles are too slow for them.
She sobbed, a terrible, terrifying sound that Valentin had never heard from her mother.
The bastards are trading with the EU and the Americans for better weapons. They say they're on the same side. They say we are lawless thieves who deprive them all of their royalties.
Valentin had heard that the Americans and the EU had declared for the other side, while the Russians and the Koreans and the Brazilians had declared for the city. The war gossip was everywhere. The old people didn't pinch her cheeks when she brought water. Not anymore. They told her about the war and the enemies who'd come to drive them back into the Dark Ages.
Mata, are you hurt?
Her mother was covering her face with her hands and sobbing so loudly it drowned out the tantrum Trover threw every night the second she came through the door. Her shoulders shook. She gulped her sobs. Then she lowered her wet, snotty, sticky hands and wiped them on the thighs of her jumpsuit. She hugged Valentin so hard Valentin felt her skinny ribs creak.
They killed your father, Valley, she said. Your father is dead.
Valentin stood numb for a moment, then pulled free of her mother's hug. No, she said, calmly. Papa is digging away from the front, where it's safe. She'd expected that her mother would die, not her father. She'd known that all along,
since her mother stepped out the door of the flat talking of heroism. Known it fatalistically and never dwelt on it, never even admitted it. In her mind, though, she'd always seen a future where her father and Trover and she lived together as heroes of this war, which would surely be over soon, and visited her mother's memorial 4 times a year, the way they did the memorials for the comrade heroes who'd been martyred in the Revolution. The death toll was gigantic. 3 apartment buildings had disappeared on her street with no air raid warning. No warning of any kind. All dead. Why should her brave mother live on? No, she said again. You're mistaken.
I saw the body,
her mother said, shrieking like Trover.
I held his head. He is dead, Valley.
Valentine didn't understand what her mother was saying, but she certainly didn't want to hang around the flat and listen to this raving. She turned on her heel and walked out of the flat. It was full dark out, and there was snow on the ground and wet snow whipping along in the wind, and she didn't have her 2 small winter coat on, but she wasn't going to stay and listen to her mother's nonsense. On the corner, a man from the city told her she was breaking curfew and told her to go home or she'd end up getting herself shot. She shivered and glared at him and ignored him and set off in a random direction. She certainly wasn't going to stand on that corner and listen to his lunacy. There were soldiers drinking in a cellar on another street, and they called out to her, and what they said wasn't the kind of thing you said to a little girl, though she knew well enough what it meant. Now she was cold and soaked through and shivering uncontrollably, and she didn't know where she was, and her father was... She began to run. Someone from the city shouted at her to stop, and so she pelted through the ruins of a bombed building and then down one of the old streets from before the Revolution, one of the streets they hadn't yet straightened out and rebuilt. The enemy hadn't bombed it yet, and she wondered if that was because this was the kind of dark and broken and smelly street they wanted the city to be returned to. So they'd left it untouched as an example of what the defenders should be working toward if they wanted to escape with their lives. Down the street she ran, and then down an alley and another street. She stopped running when she came to a dead end and her chest heaved. Running had warmed her up a little, but she hadn't had much to eat except cabbage and cold cereal with water for weeks, and she couldn't run like she used to. The cold stole back over her. It was full dark, and the blackout curtains on the windows meant that not a sliver of light escaped. The moonless, cloudy night made everything as dark as a cave. Finally, she cried. She hadn't cried since she found out that Rita had died. She hadn't even liked Rita, but to have someone die that soon after you're seeing them was scary like you had almost died. Almost. The wizard came on her there, weeping. He appeared out of the mist carrying a little light the size of a pea that he cupped in his hand to muffle most of the light. He was about her father's age, but with her mother's look of having survived something terrible without having survived altogether. He dressed like it was the old days, in fancy, bright-colored clothes, and he was well-fed in a way that no one else in the city was. "Hello there," he said. He got down on his hunker so he could look her in the eye. "Why are you crying?" Valentine hated grown-ups who patronized her, and the wizard sounded like he believed that no little girl could possibly have anything real to cry about.
"My dad died in the war today," she said, "in a trench."
"Oh, the American trench busters," he said, knowingly. "Lots of children lost their daddies today, I bet."
That made her stop crying. Lots of children. Lots of daddies. Fathers. She hated the baby word daddy. Mothers, too.
"Let's get you cleaned up, put a coat on you, feed you, and send you home, all right?"
She looked warily at him. She knew all about strange men who offered to take you home. But she had no idea where she was, and she was dark and shivering and couldn't stop. "My mother is a hero, and a soldier, and she's killed a lot of men," Valentine said. He nodded.
"I shall keep that in mind," he said.
The wizard lived in the old town, in an old building, but inside it was as new as anything she had ever seen. The walls swooped and curved. The furniture was gaily colored and new, like it had just been printed that day. There was so much light. They'd been saving it at her building. There was so much food. He gave her hamburgers and fizzy elderflower, then steak frites, then rich dumplings as big as her fist stuffed with goose livers. He had working robots, lots of them, and they scurried after him doing the dishes and tidying and wiping up the slushy footprints. And when they arrived and he took her coat, old familiar laser lights played over her, the kind of everywhere-at-once measuring lasers that they used to have at the clothing stores. By the time dinner was done, there were two pairs of fresh trousers, two woolly jumpers, a heavy winter coat, three pairs of white cotton pants. All her pants had gone gray once she'd started having to launder them, rather than get them printed fresh on Sundays. And a bra? She gave him a hard look. She had the knife she'd used on the hamburger in her hand. My mother taught me to kill, she said. The wizard had a face that looked like he spent a lot of time laughing with it, and so even when he looked scared, he also looked like he was laughing. He held up his hands.
It wasn't my idea. That's just the programming. If the printer thinks you need a bra, it makes a bra.
Lisa had a bra, though Valentine wasn't convinced she needed it. But she had noticed a certain uncomfortable jiggling weight climbing the stairs, hadn't she? Running? She hadn't looked in the mirror in, well, since the siege, practically.
There's a bathroom there to change into, he said.
His bathroom was clean and neat, and there were six toothbrushes beside the sink in a holder.
Who else lives here?
She said, coming out in her new clothes.
The bra felt really weird. I have a lot of friends who come and see me now and again. I hope you'll come back.
How come your place is like the war never happened?
I'm the wizard, that's why, he said. I can make magic.
His robots tied up her extra clothes in waterproof grip sheets for her, then helped her into a warm slicker with a hood.
Tell your mother that you met someone from the city who fed you and gave you a change of clothes, he said, holding open the door.
He'd explained to her where to go from there to get out to the old shopping street, and from there she could manage on her own, especially since he'd given her one of his little pea lights to carry with her.
You're not from the city, she said.
You got me, he said. So tell her you met a wizard.
She thought about what her mother would say to that, especially when that was the answer to the question, where have you been? I'll tell her I met someone from the city, she said.
You're a clever girl, he said.
1 week after her father died, Valentine stopped carrying water.
There's not enough food, her mother said, over a breakfast of nothing but dried fruit. The cereal was gone.
She swallowed and looked out the window.
If you dig in the trenches, we'll get 150 grams of bread a day.
Valentine looked at Trover. He hadn't had a tantrum in days. He didn't cry or even speak much anymore. I'll dig.
She dug.
6 months after her father died, Valentine stood in the queue for her bread. It was now the full heat of summer and the clothes the wizard had given her had fallen to bits the way all printer clothes did. She was wearing her father's old trousers, cut off just below the knee, and one of his shirts, with the sleeves and collar cut off. All to let a little of the lazy air in and to let a little of the sluggish sweat out. She was dirty and tired the way she always was at day's end. She was also so hungry. She and her mother didn't talk much anymore, but they didn't have to. Her mother was sometimes away on long missions, and increasingly longer. She was harrying the enemy with the guerrilla fighters, and living on pinecone soup and squirrels from the woods. Trover stayed over at the creche some nights. A lot of the little ones did. Who had the strength to carry a little boy up the stairs at the end of a day's digging, at the end of 3 days hard fighting in the woods? The bread rations were handed out in the spot where the cinny once stood. She couldn't really remember what it had been like, though she remembered Rita, the things Rita had said that made her leave the shelter, which had probably saved her life. Poor Rita. Little bitch. She was so hungry, and the line moved slowly. She had her chit from the boy from the city who oversaw the ditch digging in her part of the ditches. He was only a little older than her, but he couldn't dig because his hands had been mutilated when a bomb went off near him. He kept them shoved in his pockets, but she'd seen them and they looked like the knuckle breakers had given them a good seeing too. Every finger pointed a different direction, except for the ones that were missing altogether. There was also something wrong with him that made him sometimes stop talking in the middle of a sentence and sit down for a moment with his head tilted back. The chit, though. The boy always gave her her chit, and the chit could be redeemed for bread. If she left Trover in the creche, they would feed him. If Mata didn't come home from the fighting again tonight, the bread would be hers, and the cabbage, too. 8 months after her father died, her mother stayed away in the fighting for 3 weeks, and Valentine decided that she was dead and started sleeping in her mother's bed. Valentine cried a little at first, but she got used to it. She started to negotiate with one of the women who lived on the floor below to sell her narrow little bed for 800 grams of bread, 40 grams of butter, and, though she didn't really believe in it, 100 grams of ground beef. She never found out if the woman downstairs had any ground beef. Where would you get ground beef anyway? Even the cats and dogs and rats were all gone. For Valentine's mother came home after 3 weeks, and it turned out that she'd been in the hospital all that time having her broken bones mended. Something they could still do for some soldiers. Mata came through the door like an old woman, and Valentine looked up from the table where she'd been patiently feeding silent Trover before collapsing to sleep again. Valentine stood and looked at her, and her Mata looked at Valentine, and then her mother hobbled across the room like an old woman and gave Valentine a fierce, hard, long hug. Valentine found she was crying and also found that silent little Trover had gotten up from the table and was hugging them both. He was tall, she realized dimly, tall enough to reach up and hug her at the waist instead of the knees. And when had that happened? Her mother ate some of the dinner they'd had and took a painkiller, the old kind that came in pill form that were now everywhere. Take a few of them and you would forget your problems, or so hissed the boys she passed in the street, though she passed them without a glance or a sniff. Soon Mata was asleep, back in her bed, and Valentine was back in her bed too, but she couldn't sleep. Under her bed she had the remains of her grip sheet parcel, one of the precise robot knots remaining. In that parcel was her winter galosh. Just one. The other one had been stolen the winter before while she'd had them both off to rub some warmth back into her toes before going back to the digging. In the toe of the galosh, there was a pea-sized glowing light. She'd never considered selling it for bread, though it was very fine. Its light seemed too bright in the dark flat, so she took it outside into the hot night and used it to light her way on a secret walk through the old streets of her dirty city. 9 months after her father died, winter had sent autumn as a threatening envoy. The bread ration was cut to 120 grams, and there were sometimes pebbles in the bread that everyone knew were there to increase the weight. She was proud that when the bread was bad, she and the other diggers cursed the enemy and not the city. Everyone knew that no one had it any better. They fought and suffered together. But she was so hungry all the time, and you couldn't eat pride. One day she was in the queue for bread and reached out with her trembling hands to take her ration, and then she turned with it, and in a flash, a man old enough to be her father had snatched it out of her hands and run away with it. She chased after him, and the shrill cries of the women followed them, but he knew the rubble piles well, and he dodged and weaved, and she was so tired. Eventually, she sat down and wept. That was when she saw her first zombie. Zombieism had been eliminated when she was practically a baby, just after the revolution, years and years ago. But now it was back. The zombie had been a soldier, so maybe zombieism was coming back in the gas attacks that wafted over the trenches. His uniform hung in rags from his loose limbs as he walked in that funky disco dancer shuffle that meant zombie as clearly as the open drooling mouth and the staring, not seeing eyes. They were fast, zombies, though you could hardly believe it when they were doing that funky walk. Once they saw prey, they turned into racehorses that tore over anything and everything in their quest to rip and bite and rend and tear, screaming incoherencies with just enough words in them to make it clear that they were angry. So, so angry. She scrambled up from the curb she'd been weeping on and began to back away slowly, keeping perfectly silent. You needed to get away from zombies and then tell someone from the city so they could administer the cure. That's how you did it, back in the old days. The zombie was shambling away from her anyway. It would pass by harmlessly. But she had to get away in any event. Because it was a zombie, and it was wrong in just the same way that a giant hairy spider was wrong. Though if she found something giant and hairy today, she'd take it home for the soup pot. She didn't kick a tin or knock over a pile of rubble. She was perfectly stealthy. She hardly breathed. And that zombie saw her anyway. It roared and charged. Its mouth was almost toothless, but what teeth remained there gleamed. It had been a soldier and it had good boots, and they crunched the broken glass and the rubble as it pelted for her. She shrieked and ran, but she knew even as she did that she would never outrun it. She was starved and had already used all her energy chasing the fucking bastard who'd taken her bread. She ran anyway. But the sound of the zombie's good boots drew closer and closer, coming up on her, closing on her. A hand thumped her shoulder and scrabbled at it, and she spied a piece of steel bar. Maybe it had been a locking post for a hover car in the golden days. And she snatched it up and whirled around. The zombie grabbed for her, and she smashed its wrist like an old-timey schoolteacher with a ruler. She heard something crack, and the zombie roared again. "Bread fight, asshole, kill hungry," is what it sounded like. But one of its hands was now useless, flopping at its side. It charged her, grappling with her, and she couldn't get her bar back for a swing. Its good hand was in her hair, and it didn't stink. That was the worst part. It smelled like fresh baked bread. It smelled like flowers. Zombies smelled delicious. The part of her brain that was detached and thinking these thoughts was not the part in the front. That part was incoherent with equal parts rage and terror. The zombie would bite her soon, and that would be it. In a day, she'd be a zombie too, in need of medicine. And how many more would she bite before she got cured? In that moment, she stopped being angry at the zombie and became angry at the besiegers. They had been abstract enemies until then. An unknowable force from outside her world. But in that moment she realized that they were people like her, who could suffer like her, and she wished that they would. She wished that their children would starve. She wished that their parents would die. The old people shrivel unto death in their dry, unwatered flats. The toddlers wander the streets until sunburn or cold took them. She screamed an animal scream and pushed the zombie off her with her arms and legs, even her head, snapping it into the zombie's cheekbone as hard as she could, and something broke there, too. The zombie staggered back. They couldn't feel pain, but their balance was a little weak. It tottered, and she went after it with the bar. One whack in the knee took it down on its side. It reached with its good arm, and so she smashed that, too. Then the heaving ribs. Then the face. The hateful, leering, mouth-open, stupid face. Three smashes turned it into ruin. The jaw hung down to its chest, broken off its face. A hand seized her, and she whirled around with her bar held high and nearly brained the soldier who'd grabbed her. He wasn't a zombie, and he had his pistol out. It was pointed at her. She dropped her bar like it was red hot and threw her arms in the air. He shoved her rudely aside and knelt beside the zombie. The soldier zombie, she realized with a sick lurch, that she'd just smashed to pieces. The soldier's back was to her, but his chest was heaving like a bellows and his neck was tight. "Please," she said.
After they give him the cure, they can fix his bones. I had to hit him or he would have killed me. He would have infected me. You see that, right? I know it was wrong, but...
The soldier shot the zombie through the head. Twice. He turned around. His face was streaming with tears.
There is no cure. Not for this strain of zombieism. Once you get it, you die. It takes a week. Slower than the old kind. It gives you more time to infect new people. Our enemies are crafty, crafty, girl.
The soldier kicked the zombie.
I knew his brother. I commanded him until he was killed by a trench buster. The mother and father were killed by a shell. Now he's dead and that's a whole family gone.
The soldier cocked his head at her and examined her more closely.
Have you been bitten?
No, she said, quickly.
The gun was still in his hand. There was no cure.
You're sure?
He said. His voice was like her father's had been when she skinned her knee. Stern, but sympathetic.
If you have, you'd better tell me. Better to go quick and painless than like this thing.
He kicked the zombie again.
I'm sure, she said. Have you got any bread? A man stole my ration.
The soldier lost interest in her when she asked him for bread.
Goodbye, little girl, he said.
That night, she had a fever. She was so hot.
She got them all the time. Everyone did.
Not enough food. No heat.
No vegetables and vitamins.
You always got fevers.
But she was so hot.
She took off her clothes and let the cool air blow over her skin on her narrow bed. Trover was sleeping on the floor nearby. He had outgrown his crib long since. And he stirred irritably as she felt that air cool her sizzling skin. She ran her fingertips lightly over her body. She was never naked anymore. If you were lucky, you washed your face and hands every day. But baths, they were cold and miserable, and who wanted to haul water for them anyway? Her breasts were undeniable now. Her blood had started a few months back, then stopped. Starvation, she knew, that's what did it. But there was new hair in her armpits and at her groin. She crossed her arms over her chest and hugged herself. That's when she found the bite on her shoulder, just where it met her neck. It was swollen like a quail egg, the chocolate quail eggs from before that had grown on the trees. She could taste them even now, and so hot it felt like a coal. In the middle of the egg, at its peak, the seeping wound left behind by one of the zombie's few teeth. Now she was cold as ice, shivering nude on her thin ruin of a bed with her thin ruin of a body. She would be dead in a week. It was a death sentence, that bite. And she wouldn't go clean. She'd shamble and scream and bite. Maybe Trover. Maybe Mata. Maybe she'd find Lisa and give her a hard bite before she went. Her breath was coming in little pants now. She bit her lip to keep from screaming. She pulled her clothes back on as quietly as she could and slipped out into the night to find the wizard, clutching her pea light. Many times she'd walked toward his house in the night, but she'd always turned back. Now she had to see him. She passed three zombies in the dark, two dead on the ground and riddled with bullet holes, one leaning out a fifth-story window and screaming its incoherent rage out at the city. As she drew nearer to the wizard's door, an unshakable fatal conclusion gripped her. He was long gone, shot or gassed, or simply moved to somewhere else. It had been months and months since he'd given her the printer clothes and the dumplings, and surely he was dead now. Who wasn't? Her steps slowed as she came to his block. Each step was the work of half a minute or more. She didn't want to see his old door hanging off its hinges. Didn't want to see the ruins of the brave curves and swoops of his flat and furniture. But her steps took her to the door, and it was shut and silent as any of the doors in the street. Nothing marked it beyond the grime of the city and the scratches and scrapes that no one painted over any longer. She tried the knob. It was locked. She knocked. Silence. She knocked again,
Harder. Still silence. Crying now, she thundered on the door with her fists and kicked it with her feet. He was gone, 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 and she would be dead in a week. Then the door opened. It wasn't the wizard, but a well-fed blonde woman in a house coat with slippers. She was beautiful, a movie star, though maybe that was just because she wasn't starved nearly to death. Girl, you'd better have a good reason for waking up the whole fucking street at 3 in the morning. Her voice wasn't unkind, though she was clearly annoyed. I need to see... She dropped her voice at the last moment. I need to see the wizard. Oh, the woman said, comprehension dawning on her face. Oh, well then, come on in. Any friend of the wizard. The flat was just as she remembered it from that long ago night. The woman gestured at the kitchen and coffee smells began to emanate from it. Valentine had forgotten the smell of coffee, but now she remembered it. I'll go wake up His Majesty then, the woman said. Just sit yourself down. Valentine sat perched on the edge of the grand divan that twisted and curved along one wall of the sitting room. She knew that the seat of her trousers, filthy even before her tussle with the zombie, would leave black marks on its brave red upholstery. The conversation from down the corridor was muffled, but the tone was angry. Valentine felt her cheeks go hot, even through the fever. This place was still civilized, and she'd brought the war to it. Then the wizard came into the sitting room and waved the lights up to full bright, wincing away from the sudden illumination. He squinted at her. Do I know you? He said. Her tongue caught in her mouth. In his pajamas with his hair mussed, he still looked every inch the wizard. She couldn't finish. She tried again. You gave me clothes. My mother is a soldier. He snapped his fingers and grinned. Oh, the soldier's daughter. I remember you now. You counted the toothbrushes. You're a bright girl. She's a walking skeleton. The beautiful blonde woman was in the kitchen, tinkering with the cooker. It was the pre-war kind, capable of printing out food with hardly any intervention. Valentine was hypnotized by her fingers. You want sandwiches and fish fingers?
Start her with some drinking chocolate, Anna, the wizard said. Hot, and then a milkshake. Little girls love chocolate.
She hadn't tasted chocolate and she didn't know. Her mouth was flooded with saliva. The woman, Anna, pressed some more buttons and then took down a bottle of rum from a cupboard. Will you have rum in yours, little girl?
She's a little young for rum, Anna, the wizard said.
He sat down on one of his curvy sofas and it embraced him and unfurled a footrest. I'll have rum, she said. She was dying, and she wouldn't die without at least having one drink. Once. Good girl, Anna said. There's a war on, after all. She poured a liquid with the consistency of mud into a tall mug, and then added a glug or two of rum and pushed it across the counter, then fixed one for herself. Come and get it. No waitress service here. Valentine took off her two small shoes and walked over the carpet in her dirty bare feet. It felt like something she barely remembered. Grass? The chocolate smelled wonderful. Wonderful was the word for it. It made her full of wonder. Rich. Something from another planet. From heaven, maybe. She lifted the mug and felt its warmth seep into her hands. She took a tentative sip and held it in her mouth. It was spicy. Was chocolate spicy? She didn't think so. The rum made her tongue tingle and the heat made its fumes rise in her head, carrying up the chocolate taste and the peppers. Her eyes streamed. Her ears felt like they were full of chocolate. She swallowed and gasped and the wizard laughed. She looked at him.
Anna's recipe. She adds the chilies. I think it's lovely, don't you? Aztec chocolate, we call it.
She took another mouthful, held it, swallowed. The chocolate was in her tummy, too, and there was a feeling there, a greedy feeling.
A more feeling. She drained the glass. Anna and the wizard both laughed. Anna handed her a tall frosted metal cup with a mountain of whipped cream on top and a straw sticking out. Chocolate malted, she said. The perfect chaser. Transfixed in her bare feet on the carpet, she drank this. A cold headache hit her between the eyes, and that didn't stop her from going on drinking. Wow! Wow! Were there tastes like this? Did things really taste this good? The straw made slurping noises as she chased down the last of the rich liquid. Sit now, the wizard said. Let that work its magic, and then we'll put some food down your gullet. She walked to the sofa. It was like walking on the deck of a rocking ship, or on the surface of the moon. Everything slid beneath her. I'm drunk, she thought. I'm 14 years old, and I am drunk as a skunk. She lowered herself carefully and sat up as straight as she could. Now, young lady, what brings you to my home in the middle of the night? She remembered the bite on her neck and thought for a panicky second that she would throw up. I needed to talk to you, she said. I needed some help. What kind of help? She couldn't say it. She had the new kind of zombieism, and the soldier had explained it clearly. The cure for zombieism now was a bullet to the head. Then she knew what she must say. The chocolate helped. Her family would love chocolate. I'm going away soon, and my mother and brother won't be able to take care of themselves. I need help to keep them safe once I go.
Where are you going?
The drink made it hard to think, but that was balanced out by that precious and magical feeling of fullness in her belly. Her mind flew over all the possible answers. I have found someone who'll take me out of the city into a safe place.
Are there safe places?
Anna said.
Oh, Anna, you cynic, the wizard said. There are many, many safe places. The world is full of them. They are the exception, not the rule. Isn't that why you've come here?
We're not talking about why I came here, Anna said. She nodded back at Valentine and made a little scooting hand gesture at her. Valentine couldn't decide if she liked Anna, though Anna was very pretty. I need help for my family, she said.
And why would I give help? The wizard said.
He was still smiling, but that face of his, the face that looked like he'd been wounded and never quite healed, it was set in an expression that scared her a little. His eyes glittered in the low light of the swooping sitting room. She found that she had slumped against the sofa, and now it had her in its soft embrace. Because you helped me before, she said.
I see, the wizard said. So you assumed that because I'd been generous, very, very generous, to you once before, that I'd be generous again? You repay my favor with a request for another one?
Valentine shook her head.
No?
I will find a way to repay it, she said. I can work for you.
I don't need any ditches dug around here. Thank you.
Somewhere in the flat, a door opened and shut. She heard muffled voices. Lots of them. The flat was full of people. Somewhere. I can do lots of kinds of work, she said. She attempted a smile. She didn't know what she was offering him, but she knew that she was too young to be offering it. And besides, with zombieism, you shouldn't do that sort of thing. She would be safe, though, and careful, so that he would live to help her family. Anna crossed past her in a flash, and then she smacked the wizard, a crack across the face hard enough to rock his head back. His cheek glowed with the print of her open hand. Don't you toy with this little girl, she said. You see how desperate she is? Don't you toy with her. She whirled on Valentine, who stood her ground even though she wanted to shrink away. If she was old enough to offer herself to the wizard, she was old enough to stand her ground before this beautiful, well-fed blonde woman.
And you, Anna said. You aren't a fool, I can tell. So don't act a fool. There are 1,000 ways to survive that don't involve lying on your back, and you must know them or you wouldn't have survived this long. Be smart or be gone. I won't watch you make a tragedy of yourself.
Anna, What do you know about survival? The wizard said. He had one hand to his cheek, and he was giving her the same glittering look he'd given to Valentine a moment before.
Just don't play with her, Anna said. Help her or get rid of her, but don't play with her.
Go and see to the others, Anushla, the wizard said. I will negotiate in the best of faith with our friend here and call you in to review the terms of our deal when it's all done. All right?
Anna looked toward the corridor where the voices were coming from and back to the wizard, then to Valentine.
Be smart, girl, she said.
The wizard brought her a plate of goose liver dumplings smothered in white gravy and then took a bite out of a big toasted corned beef sandwich that oozed brown mustard.
Right, he said. No playing. If you want to work for me, there are jobs that need doing. Have you ever seen stage magic performed? The kind with tuxedos and white doves?
She nodded slowly. Before the war, she said.
You know how the magician always has a supply of lovely assistants on hand.
She nodded again. They'd worn flattering, tight-fitting calf-high trousers, cutaway coats, tummy-revealing crop tops, and feathered confections for hats.
Everyone who does magic has an assistant or two. I'm the wizard and I do the best magic of all, and so I have need of more assistants than most. I have an army of assistants, and they help me out, and I help them out.
I'm leaving in 5 days, she said.
The kind of favor I had in mind from you was the kind of favor that you could perform the day after tomorrow.
And you'd take care of my family?
I would do that, he said. I always take care of my assistants' families. Do we have an agreement?
She stuck her hand out and they shook.
Eat your dumplings, he said, and then we'll get you some things to take home to your family.
2 days after the wizard agreed to take care of Valentine's family, the fever had become her constant companion, so omnipresent that she hardly noticed it, though it made her walk like an old woman and she sometimes had trouble focusing her eyes. She arose that morning and feasted on brown rolls with hard crusts, small citrus cakes, green beef tea, porridge with currants and blueberry concentrate and sweet condensed milk, and a chocolate bun to top it off. Trover ate even more than she did, licking up the crumbs. She saw him hide 2 of the jackfruits under his shirt and nodded satisfaction. He had learned something about surviving then. Her mother had not questioned the food, nor the clothes, nor her daughter's absence that night. But oh, she had given Valentine a look when she came through the door carrying all her parcels, a look that said, "Not my daughter anymore." Not a look that refused what she bore, but a look that refused her. Valentine didn't bother trying to explain. She knew what her mother suspected, and it was better in some ways than the truth. Her mother drank the real coffee reverently, with 3 sugars and thick, no-refrigeration cream. She ate sardines on toast, green beef tea, and a heap of fluffy scrambled eggs with minced herring. Then she put on her uniform and took up her gun and went out the door, without a look back at Valentine.
By the end of the week, she won't have to worry about me, Valentine thought.
The fever made her fingers shake, but she still drank her hot chocolate. Trover knew his own way to the crash, and so Valentine went forth to earn her family's fortune. The wizard had given her a small sack of little electronic marbles and had told her to get them planted in no fewer than 300 locations at the front and in the places where the fighting was likely to move. They were spy eyes, the kind of thing that she and her friends had exchanged to keep in one another's rooms before the war, so they could sneak midnight conversations in perfect encrypted secrecy.
If I'm caught, she said.
You'll be shot, he said. You must be. The alternative is that you'll lead them back to me. And if you do that, the whole game is up. Your family's lives, my life, your life, the lives of all my assistants and friends will be forfeit. It will be terrible. They will destroy this place. They will destroy your home, too.
She didn't report for her digging. That was okay. Lots of people didn't show up to dig on the days when they were feeling too weak to hold a shovel. She wouldn't be missed.
She had the fastest shoes that the wizard could print for her on her feet, though she'd carefully covered them in grime and dirt so they wouldn't stand out. And she'd taken an inhaler along that would make her faster still. He'd warned her to keep eating after she took the inhaler, or she'd starve to death before the day was out. The pockets on both thighs of her jumpsuit were stuffed with butterballs wrapped around sugared kidneys and livers, stuff that would sustain her no matter how many puffs she took. No one challenged her on the way to the front. There were some her age who fought, and many more who served those who fought, bringing forward ammunition, digging new trenches right at the front. The pay for this was better than the pay she'd gotten digging in the safe trenches. She brought a shovel for camouflage. The first round of trenches were familiar, the same kind she'd been digging in for months now. She even saw some of the diggers she'd dug alongside of, nodding to them, though her heart was thumping.
"You'll be shot," she thought,
and she palmed an electronic eye and stuck it to the wall of a trench. She moved forward and forward, closer to the fighting. It had always been a dull, distant rattle, the fighting, never quite gone, but not always there, either. Instinctively, she'd kept her distance from it, always moving away from it. Today, she moved toward it, and her blood sang. One trench over, there came the dread zizz sound of a trench buster, and she threw herself down. There were antibusters in the trenches, too, but they didn't always work. The trench busters were mostly up around the front, but they sometimes came back to the diggers, and they had killed one crew she knew of. There were screams from the next trench, then a sound like a bag of gravel being poured out. That was the antibuster, she knew. And the trench buster soared out overhead of her and detonated in the sky, mortally confused by the counter logic in the antibuster. She realized that she had peed herself. Just a little, just a few drops that must have escaped when she gave her involuntary shriek. She planted her hands in the frozen dirt of the trench floor and got to her knees. That was when she saw the fingertip, shriveled and frozen, lying just a few inches from her. It had been cleanly severed. She had seen so much death, but the fingertip, cut off and left there to dry out and be trampled down into the dirt. It made her stomach do slow somersaults. She threw up a little and peed herself a little more, and her eyes watered. That's when she knew she couldn't complete the wizard's mission. There was death ahead for her that day, much death to see at the front, and she couldn't face that. Not when her pockets were full of spy eyes, and that meant espionage. Meant that the wizard was on the other side. The side of the bastards whose old people she would starve in their high flats and whose children she would tear from their beloved parents. The fever made her shake hard now. Her head swam and the world pitched and yawed like a ship in heavy seas. She stood up and took a step. It was a funky disco dancer step. Her next step was too. Then she was walking normally again. She reached down into her shirt, between her breasts. She had a bra on again, fresh from the wizard's printer, and withdrew the inhaler he'd given her. She'd be dead in a week. She put the inhaler to her lips and drew in a deep breath while squeezing it. And then the fever was gone. The horror was gone. The fear and cold were gone. What was left behind was a hard, frenetic grin, something that sharpened her every sense and set her feet alight like the most infectious of dance music.